Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times, and just like that, the men's Six Nations is all over. Ireland are champions again, France a second again, but below that, the story looks very different. England heartbroken in Lyon, but a side building for the future. Scotland beaten in Dublin, but a side whose future looks uncertain. Wales reject Gatland's offer of resignation, and Italy celebrate into the Cardiff night once more. Welcome back. I'm Alfie Reynolds, and to help me round up the final weekend of action, we're going to be hearing from Will Kelleher and Alex Lowe from Lyon. They have recorded a dispatch following that pretty bonkers finale, and I am joined by Elgin Alderman. Elgin, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Alfie. How are you?
I am all right, thank you. Are you recovered from a Six Nations of seeing Wales, covering Wales, and seeing them get their first wooden spoon since 2003?
Well, I've seen it all before. I was only 9 years old when the last one happened. So, you know, I've had one as a boy and now I've had one as a man. So hopefully that's the one as a man done. There's no more there.
Yeah, well, if what happened after 2003 is anything to go by, you might be all right. But I think that's part of the fear with Wales at the moment of whether that's going to be the case. And we're also joined by Mark Palmer, who, like Elgin, Mark, is it fair to say, have suffered through another Six Nations from a Scottish point of view?
Probably just about the right summation, Alfie. Yes, a few highs, lots of lows, and a lot somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, quite right. So on the pod, as I say, we'll hear from Will and Alex from Lyon. We're going to round up the Ireland-Scotland game and the Wales-Italy game. We're also going to have a look ahead to the Women's Six Nations. That starts this weekend, and we'll name a god or goddess of the week as usual. But Elgin and Mark, before we get on to those individual matches that you were both at, broadly speaking, what did you make of the final weekend, and what did you make of the culmination in this year's championship?
Well, they were certainly, you know, it wasn't quite the Super Saturday of a few years ago where we just had tries coming in left, right and centre. But there was something in all of those games. I think 15 games now of that Six Nations, and there were 9 losing bonus points. So 9 of the 15 games, let alone within 7 points, I think were won by fewer than 5. So lots of close games, and 3 more on the final weekend, you know, decided by 3 points, 4 points and 2 points. As you say, slightly bonkers finale, which had a bit of everything. France, England, you know, had some great intrigue, some controversy, some exciting attacking play from both sides. Ireland, Scotland was a bit more, you know, just how were Scotland holding on in the barrage of, I think, more than 250 attempted tackles. And in Wales, Italy, you had Italy, you know, confirming their best Six Nations ever with 2 wins and a draw. They'd had 2 wins before, but you know, there was plenty there across all 3 games. Very, very exciting to end a very, with the exception of Ireland, who weren't quite as all-conquering as people thought they would be, but a very even championship where the teams below Ireland certainly just about could have beaten anyone on their day.
Yeah, what did you make of it, Mark? As Elgin says, I felt like it was a really good Six Nations. It maybe won't go down as a complete classic for a few different reasons, partly because no Grand Slam, and also I think because even though the title, in theory, went down to the final day between multiple teams, it would have taken quite a huge upset for Ireland not to have ended up winning it. But despite that, because of just how close a number of those games has been. Elgin going through the stats there. It's been a pretty fascinating championship, hasn't it?
It has. And I think it's, you know, there's been full of intrigue because of the sort of very, very similar level of a number of the sides. I mean, in the last number we've had, you know, Ireland and France and the rest. This year has been kind of Ireland and the rest, but even the disparity between them and the rest hasn't been so pronounced when, you know, you see they get knocked over at Twickenham and Scotland running them close in Dublin. So I think there's been storylines around every single game. There's been, you know, pretty much all of them. But by the exception of that, that Ireland-France win in the first weekend has been a contest. So, you know, there's been lots to talk about, lots to write about. And, you know, if the general level of rugby might not have been to everyone's taste up until the final weekend, I think that one, for sheer drama, it's been one of the more exciting.
Bit of an unfair question, maybe, Elgin. I'll ask Mark this as well. If I say to you, who's the story or what's the story of this Six Nations, what would you go for? If you had to pick out one kind of narrative, team or whatever it might be, what sticks out to you the most?
I mean, possibly just through the lens of the team I've been covering, I think it's been very rare in the Six Nations era for teams other than Italy and Scotland to win that wooden spoon. We've seen France do it once in 2013. So to see Wales drop to that level where it had been predicted for, you know, it's been forecasted for a long time that Welsh rugby is in a lot of trouble and that there is pain ahead. And I think a lot of it, people that don't follow necessarily Wales that closely haven't realised just how bad the results have been for quite some time, because this is now 14 defeats in the past 16 Six Nations games since they lost a Grand Slam decider in 2021, again, when Wayne Pivak was still in charge. So, you know, two tournaments in a row where they only won one, and now suddenly this big headline of the wooden spoon, the first since 2003, finally now it's, oh, everyone's realised, wow, Wales are where they are, sixth in the Six Nations.
I'm going to go for Italy has been the story of the tournament. I think they've been tremendous, and you know, they've been a regular defender of them down the years, and kind of felt often a bit of a lone voice when among those conversations about whether they even merited a place at this top table. But they, you know, there's been a sense of something building there for a number of years. You know, they've really sorted out their age grade system, and the results have been coming, certainly under 18 and under 20 level. We've seen that again this year when they beat the world champions France away from home, and those players being bled into the national system are, you know, that is now bearing fruit in terms of results. So under their new coach Quezada, they're playing a much more balanced game. That kind of run it from everywhere style that they had under Crowley has evolved into something more substantial, you know, and they really should be able to finish that with three wins. We still haven't explained the gust of wind in the indoor stadium that knocked over that ball for poor Paolo Garbisi, but you know, they were well worth both their win in Cardiff and against Scotland last week in Rome. So, and to my mind, you know, they would have been well worthy of a win in France as well. So, an excellent tournament from them, and the only way is up, I think, for that whole movement.
Yeah, for what it's worth, I would go with Italy as well. I think the beauty of the Six Nations is, frankly, you could pick out any narrative or any team, and there are things that are fascinating, particularly if we start to look ahead into the future with Ireland, that series against the Springboks, England with their tour, well, their match against Japan and then their tour in New Zealand, where France are after a shaky start, but actually they've still ended up finishing second when, broadly speaking, it's been pretty negative about them. So I think there are storylines everywhere. It's one of the reasons the Six Nations is great, but I think the significance of Italy, as you say, Elgin, the best performance they've ever had in the championship because of the two wins and the draw and the things you speak about, Mark, of we get the sense that maybe it isn't just a kind of flash in the pan and then they'll go back to the wooden spoon, which maybe actually we can get onto later when we speak about that game in more detail.
It seems unfair after all that Italy have ended up finishing fifth. I mean, on the final day, they could, with a series of silly results on the final day, they could have ended up in third, but they've ended up fifth again, which yeah, it does seem unfair. But again, that plays into what we were talking about with bonus points and so many narrow results that they've, in terms of the table, not their best tournament ever. But yeah, the two wins in the draw was superb for Italy.
Yeah, all right. Well, another great Six Nations. We will be back with us fairly shortly as we'll get into Ireland against Scotland, Wales against Italy. But first up, we're going to be heading over to France and to Lyon, where Will Kelleher and Alex Lowe are standing by for their report after they were covering England in that narrow defeat to France on the final weekend.
Hello Alfie, hello everyone, and welcome to Lyon, where Alex and I are neatly perched A Côte du Rhône, the oui. lapping you may be able to hear in the background behind us is the tide of the river, atmospheric. I know it's actually raining a bit, so don't feel too jealous of our position. It's not quite, Alex, a nice rooftop in Rome, is it?
No, that was fun, but it is beautiful. Lyon is a beautiful city, and if it wasn't for the stadium being miles out of town, it would be just a brilliant place for Six Nations to be every year. I mean, the stadium is compact, it's tall, steep. The atmosphere was better than anything, I think, at the Stade de France, which can generate some noise, but it was loud on Saturday night. It's been a great visit here. I came a couple of times during the World Cup, so Wales beat Australia here. So there have been some memorable games I've been to in the Groupama Stadium.
Yeah. Do we know what Groupama is?
No. I only know it's the home of Olympique Lyonnais, who used to have Lucas Paqueta in their ranks, who now plays for the mighty West Ham. So that's my only link, really, of Lyon. But no, we've had a great weekend. Probably the sporting highlight was Team Times, you and me,
ooh,
on the paddle court this morning, taking down previously undefeated duo.
Mm. Well, not undefeated, well, they're not undefeated. Just reigning paddle champions of the journalistic pack.
Reigning rugby writers, paddle champions, Dan Schofield and
Gerard Maher,
from The Telegraph, one from The Guardian. They teamed up and had won. I think they've been undefeated, certainly since the World Cup.
Yeah, there's contention, let's just say. Anyway. Chris Jones from the BBC would say that is a false title. But he wasn't in Lyon, he was in Dublin.
And so I was back from injury, so you had Chris Jones as your partner for a while.
Yeah. I think we need to work out our club country agreement, because you got injured at the World Cup,
yeah.
And the data we received about your calf problem was a bit hazy, and so we maybe should sort that out in our enhanced EPS system.
But listen, you and I, we took down Chris Ashton and Richard Wigglesworth, and now we've taken down the Telegraph and Guardian Dream Team. So, listen, bring it on.
I do like that everyone's tuning in being like, right, I really want to know what the verdict is on that that epic game in Lyon, and they've got 2 minutes of our terrible paddle.
It was an epic game in Lyon, but on the paddle court.
Yeah, it was. Should we get into it? It was a great finish to the Six Nations. It was. I was going to make a hilariously funny thing and say we're in the belly of France, and in England got a kick in the guts, didn't they? Like, it was...
Yeah.
It was brutal, wasn't it? Like, they had the game won, and then they didn't. And people who've picked up their times this morning will see that our friend and referee, Rob Debney, it wasn't very happy with the final call. Should we start at the end and then work our way backwards?
I don't know, because half an hour in, you and I were having a chat, and I was like, this feels like it could get ugly. England were 16-3 down, and they were losing every collision.
Getting marmalised.
They were getting
front.
Smashed, and they couldn't get... They were getting dragged into that physical battle. They couldn't generate anything in attack. They were having the ball stripped out of their possession. They just couldn't cope with the French power. And it's 13-3, 16-3 down. I'm thinking this looks worrying for England. This could get ugly. And then in a 5-minute blitz either side of half time, England surged from 16-3 down to 24-16 ahead. And you're like, wow, here they come. They would then be gutted at the end of it because they... Silly errors. A silly penalty from Marcus Smith. I just don't think George Furbank sort of jumps into...
Or Freddie Stewart
into Barre in the way that Smith did. It's just a little naive from a player who isn't a natural fullback. From that penalty, France score. Theo Dan overthrows a line out from that France score.
When Itoji was facing the wrong way and wasn't
just
quite
the
ready.
The timing was off. And it was interesting that he came on so early, 50-odd minutes... France had brought on their new front row, and England then replied in kind. And that was the earliest he's been brought on in a big game. Regrets, frustrations, and then England come back again. Tommy Freeman scores.
Lovely little flick on from George Ford, by the way.
George Ford's hands, you know, and I've written a bit about George Ford for Monday's paper, but he's been so integral to the change in England. And that little flick, that touch of his to get it to Smith, to get it wide to Freeman, just brilliant. And then you think England have done it. And then comes the marginal call against Ben Earl on the halfway line for a no-arms tackle. And I think it probably was marginally a no-arms tackle. He would probably say, and you can sort of see, is he trying to wrap? Maybe. But he's slightly turned his shoulder. But the referee didn't spot it. It came from the TMO. And I have a a pretty strong sense that England would be frustrated by the TMO getting involved for that kind of a call at that time in the game.
Just to cover it off, technically he is allowed to come in for those. He's not allowed to come in for things like technical offences like offsides and stuff like that.
Or a deliberate knock-on.
That's what the assistant refs are for.
There was another moment where, just before Smith's try, when Barre seemed to knock the ball on when Freeman was passing to Mitchell. And I'm pretty sure England will be frustrated that that didn't turn into a yellow card.
But foul play incidents,
foul play,
he is allowed to come in.
Yeah.
And I think the point that Rob Debney was making in his column this morning was essentially Angus Gardner is an incredibly experienced referee. He's been referee of the year a few years ago and has refereed a lot of test matches. Right. Ben Whitehouse is fairly inexperienced referee, but he's done a lot of TMOing. And he's got to be absolutely 100% sure that that's a clanger. And, like, again, technically, probably right. But is that the decision you make, 79th minute of the game, match-winning pen?
We discussed it because it's an interesting talking point. You know, and it resulted in Thomas Ramos kicking the longest penalty of the championship to win the game for France. You know, England gutted by it. I think it's an interesting conversation because it's representative of this feeling that the TMO is getting involved too much in rugby.
100%,
It resulted in the match-winning penalty for France on this occasion. And the TMO at the moment can come in for foul play, but I think what people believe that should mean is, you know, dangerous play, a high tackle, or a no arms tackle, you know, like a shoulder charge to the chin, not a no arms tackle to the hip, which is really what it was.
Chop tackle kind of thing.
It properly dangerous. That to me wasn't dangerous, and so I think there's a general frustration that the TMOs are taking over too much of the refereeing of matches. For me, this situation is indicative of that conversation. It just so happened that it went against England on this occasion. But I do feel, and it's been odd a little bit today, right, trying to sum up a championship. And for the first time in a long time, England have lost a game, and they finished third in the championship. They won 3 out of 5, which is an improvement on the last 4 years, which is both indicative of how bad things have been, but also a step forward. But it's the manner in which they beat Ireland, the manner in which they went about solving problems on Saturday night and then taking the game to France, means that even in defeat, it feels like this is a new start for England, and there's a lot to be excited by and a lot of young players to be excited about. And it feels like England have pulled themselves out of this rut and are playing in a positive, proactive way. They're going out to try and win matches. Execution has improved as the tournament's gone on. Right from the Italy game where we sat there in Rome and saw them, they were attacking from deeper and at pace, but they were still bedeviled by England's issue of they can't convert pressure into points. But oddly, so those first three games, Italy, Wales, and then defeat to Scotland, they scored 6 tries. In those 3 games a year ago, they scored 11 tries. So you're thinking, well, where is this great attacking revolution?
Although, albeit in 2023, quite a lot of those tries were coming from the pack, weren't they?
They did, yeah.
Because the backs could hardly score. That was our 6 hours without a back try,
between,
wasn't it?
Between the France game and the Fiji game in the World Cup warm-ups. But that Scotland game, as painful as it was to make all those errors, has, I think, could well go down as a key
line in the sand,
a key
kind
moment
of, yeah.
in the development of this team, because they definitely reframed their training. They have placed more emphasis on attack, and against Ireland and France, they've scored 7 tries in 2 tests, and they've just looked sharper. The execution's been better because they, on the back of that Scotland game, where through all the errors, they then lost faith in what they were trying to do. Even on Saturday night, when they were getting battered physically for half an hour, they didn't lose faith in what they were trying to do. They just found a better way to go about achieving it. And I'm optimistic about where this team's going because they're going out to try and win games, and they're adapting a bit on the hoof. They didn't do it in Scotland, but they did do it against Wales. They went a bit narrower in the second half.
Shut the game down a bit.
Fine, do it. That's how you go and win the game. But that's also a proactive move. Although it's narrowing the ambition down, it's a proactive move within the game to go, right, here's how we see we can win this game.
Foot on the ball.
I like that. And George Ford has just been, you know, he threw a couple of wayward passes against Scotland, but I think he's been outstanding for England in this championship. And there have been a few great players, Ben Earl probably the player of the championship. George Ford, and he spoke really interestingly, didn't he, after the game, yeah, about his shift. I mean, you were part of the conversation, I was talking to someone else, but you explained his shift in mindset, which actually reflects England's shift.
Yeah, completely. So we've always found over the years that George Ford has been a great guy to get the temperature of the team with. Like when in 2020 he was talking about the ball being a ticking time bomb, he was reflecting the mindset of that side. And on Saturday night, gone midnight, in the mix zone talking to him, he totally reflected what we have seen with our eyes is this change in the last couple of weeks after the Scotland game where they went, that's not us. What the hell was that? Let's reset. And he spoke about it, according to himself and the team, and was saying, I was looking at myself in these games and going, why am I playing so deep? Why am I obsessed with managing the game and sort of getting boxed into this thing of I've got to be the game manager? The best I've always been is flat to the line, fast, challenging defences, being aggressive. And we had a decision to make about who we wanted to be, what type of team we wanted to be. And he was interesting too, because he was saying that the sort of general perception is that defence helps attack, whereas actually he was like, the opposite can be true too, where attack can help defence, because if you're challenging teams so much, it helps you defend because they're on the back foot and everything else. And I think he was basically just reflecting that mindset shift of saying, and I don't think quite in the realms of football style player power and big arguments and stuff like that with the coaching staff, but it does seem like there was a sort of realisation moment where they said, what are we trying to do here? Are we playing to our strengths? No. Okay, what about playing like this? And then they immediately have seen the evidence of it. And like, we were watching the game in the stands, weren't we? We were saying, there's no point running straight at these French guys because they're all massive and England just don't have enough big guys to get through them. But then it's the second quarter and the third quarter, either side of half-time, they started finding kind of Irish-style little passes on the line, didn't they?
Against
Earl or a Slade to Lawrence.
Yeah.
And they're finding that soft shoulder, that little gap. And that was all part of it, wasn't it? And so I think we need to just give the respect to Ford for that as well.
Definitely. And there was a moment when Earl, right at the start of the second half, so it must have been the second try, he got hit, knocked back on the gain line. But maybe I'm giving him too much credit here, but watching it live, it felt to me like he sort of accepted the tackle, because Ben Earl doesn't accept tackles. He's always trying to drive, break through a tackle or earn some extra yards. But actually, by being hit and going down, the ball was lightning fast, and off the back of it, England did, there was no ruck. They didn't get dragged into anything.
Mitchell was gone,
the ball was gone, and England end up scoring. And those kind of little shifts, those changes, that's smart from England, but smart from the players. And Ford has been integral to it, really. You did a piece earlier in the championship about, he's hit 90 odd, he's now 97 caps, and so many of them were alongside or sitting behind Owen Farrell as the dominant character, the captain of this team. Well, Farrell's not in the team anymore, and Ford has really taken hold of things, it feels to me.
Yeah. 31st birthday as well. I think people still, because he started so young, keep forgetting. Yeah. Like, he's been around for 15 years as a club and country player, but he's only 31. Like, I think it's way, way premature to say, oh, last legs of George Ford. Like, I think he's really shown in this championship. And actually, like, World Cup last year, one of his great games, that Argentina pool match with the drop goals and everything else, all the points. He's grabbed hold of it, hasn't he?
I think what I like about him is, and I've put this in Monday's piece, so I will be repeating myself if you've read it, but
which all of the Ruck listeners surely have.
Just the idea that he, if you look at the different teams he's been part of, they've often played very differently. The sort of fluid, flat-to-the-line rugby at Bath in 2015 through to that Autumn Nations Cup where England had a strategy that was kind of negative, but that's the way that they wanted to play, through to the Borthwick-Leicester team that was kick pressure to what they're trying to do now. He's a master at being... He's so versatile and intelligent and with a broad skill set that he can play whichever way he's asked to play. We're not proclaiming them as champions. They're a long way off. Danny Kerr afterwards said this is a team that could, they could hit the heights. They could be an amazing team. Well, they couldn't scale the heights on Saturday night. There's a lot of climbing to be done. but Steve Borthwick always refers to the Kubler-Ross curve, and when he took over, England were on the downslope, and then they carried on going down for a while, and the World Cup has dragged them back up into, you know, the upward trajectory, and that's now, he's now continued that. So I think there's a lot of optimism around the squad on the back of the Six Nations. Going out, they play Japan and then two tests in New Zealand, which is a daunting challenge. One at Eden Park, where, you know, they just don't lose.
94 but, last defeat.
Yeah, but England will, you know, if Borthwick can get a full fit squad, and that is a concern for him, I'm sure. Like, he doesn't have any, he's sending all the players back to the Premiership now for the run in, the European,
which is going to be
run in,
like the Grand National, isn't it?
Really,
it's ridiculous.
Yeah, crazy. He's going to have to sit and wait and see who is actually available for him by the end. But if he gets a full squad together, then what you do know is England will go out there and give it a go. And after so many years of watching England getting more and more disjointed and dysfunctional, and winning a series in Australia, but really because they dug in, Courtney Laws dragged them over the line. Like, there's some hope and some optimism around England. Albeit, you know, we're not counting on chickens. They've only won 3 out of 5. They finished third. There's a long way to go, but it's heading in the right direction, I think, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I guess that the next challenge for Borthwick is breaking this cycle that England have been in of performing however they perform in a championship, dispersing, going away. Squad is fairly different the next time they come together, and then it's that whole
starting
thing of
again.
Oh, we've only had a week of training, and like,
he can't.
We're shambling all
together. I mean, the only way he breaks that cycle is to completely change the structure.
Yeah,
and you know, as much as he might want to, I don't think that's going to change.
He's not going
to
get what he wants.
I think if Steve Borthwick was to write what he would want in England, these England contracts to be that are going to be given out to 25. Core England players next season, how he would write those contracts will be very different to what they're going to look like.
A camel is a horse designed by committee.
He's going to get better access to medical data.
Which is insane they don't share that
anyway.
Which
is a step forward, given that...
Or not all of it.
He discovered at the start of the Six Nations that actually Ollie Lawrence wasn't going to be available.
He's playing with a hip injury for
Bath. Been playing with a hip injury and he didn't know anything about it.
And they found out the day he joined up at camp, and then they were like, all right, so you're going to have to miss the first two games. Great, we've just designed quite a lot of our attack around you playing 12.
Exactly. So that will be an improvement. There will be some sort of fitness management, closer fitness management of players in terms of... like, fitness scores, but also managing their recovery and that kind of thing, but no influence over how often players play or where they play, and that is interesting.
Like, position,
me.
You mean?
By position, and that's interesting for me because Marcus Smith played 73 minutes at fullback. Quinn's never playing him at fullback.
No.
Asher Opoku for Jaw at Sale Sharks. Sale see him as a tight head. They believe he could become like he could set the standards for what a tight head is.
Becomes in the future.
Become in the future. England see him as a loose head.
Mm.
Like, how do you square that circle? That's the English system, which every England coach in the professional era has banged his head against the wall over. And as much as Borthwick will, you know, through the relationships he's going to try and build with the clubs, Eddie Jones just gave up on it.
Yeah,
he's like, this is not going to work. Don't trust the clubs. I'll have no relationship with them, which I think is counterproductive. Steve has a different approach. That's not his way. He's going to try and work with them. But ultimately, unless Twickenham signs players on a central contract, that system that you describe of England having to fundamentally start again, I mean, there's a lot that will carry through, but pretty much start again every time they come into camp. That can't be broken unless the system changes.
Yeah. Okay, well, why don't we do just a couple of minutes on France and maybe the occasion and everything else, because it was brilliant.
Yeah, lovely.
It's been fun that France have moved it around. It's necessity, isn't it, because of the Olympics, and there was some suggestion that they sort of didn't mind moving the games around the country because they thought they'd have won the World Cup and would have taken the trophy around to everyone, but it didn't happen.
I mean, I don't know why they don't do it more often, because they don't. It's not like they own the Stade de France.
No.
And
traditionally, the heartlands are in the south. I know we're not right down in the south yet, but they were in Marseille, weren't they?
Yeah.
Although, albeit a football
ground. The opening game in Marseille.
Awesome, yeah.
They were blown away, but the place was jumping, and here it was jumping, and it was great. It was a great occasion. And actually, good for the championship to see France rally.
So we like our listeners to send us emails, and we have got an email. We've got
actually
lots
from IT
of email.
This week?
No, we have one from IT, which is someone who shouldn't be emailing us, being blocked by the system, I think. But we have got an email, which is about what we've been talking about, of the sort of matchday experience, I suppose, in Lyon, which is maybe lots of England fans have not been here, and unless their club team's been here. And it's from Tom Innes, who people may or may not know, used to work for Jersey Reds. Unfortunately, they hit the wall, didn't they, at the end of last season. But he was saying Lyon was a bit weird. I can't recall being in a city hosting a big game where there was less evidence of Le Match.
Yeah.
At 6:45 p.m., just over 2 hours before kickoff, two of us walked into a bar within half a mile of the main station, and it was a start point for trams to the stadium, and there were three customers there. Fortunately, things picked up massively at the ground. And I suppose that's, I don't know, we're in football country. I know Lyon do have an elite top 14 side, don't they? They're in Champions Cup and everything else, but we're at the football ground. This is Olympic Lyonnais,
yeah.
Although albeit our taxi driver was a Marseille fan, yeah. Wasn't he? But
yeah. And it's also, by 6:45, everyone's gone out to the stadium.
And it's quite out
it's
of
so
the way,
far
isn't
out,
it?
Yeah. It's so far out. So, I do know it felt different in the World Cup. It felt different. I mean, there were way more Wales fans here in the World Cup than there were England fans here on Saturday, for example. And when we went to Lille in the World Cup, England fans sort of took over the city square. It didn't feel quite like that.
No.
There weren't quite as many travelling. But certainly by the time Tom hit the bar, I think most people were out at the stadium because it's trams only, really, or a very punchy cab ride, and you've got to get there early.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is going to be us from Lyon as the rain dribbles on the Rhône in front of us. But we're going to be back. Alfie will talk you through it in later in the pod, but pods will keep on coming. Premiership running, Women's Six Nations coming up. We're going to cover a bit of that as well, as we usually do. European Games might be back in France later in the spring. But for now, from Lyon, from our little spot on the Rhône, Alex, good trip, well placed, good Six Nations.
Let's get a bottle of Côte d'Aron.
Yeah, oh, good idea. Hang on. Okay. It's Monday morning, people are listening to this, so they might think we've really hit the wall.
I think they probably know us by now.
But no, pleasure to be here. Pleasure to be here for the Times and for the Ruck. But for now, let's hand back to Alfie in the studio.
Thanks, Will. Thanks, Alex. Good to hear from the boys. Done a sterling job, as always, covering England this championship. And interesting as well, Elgin and Mark, to hear about their victory in paddle tennis in this Six Nations. Seems to be a big thing amongst a lot of the travelling press pack of the various different teams. So I think the first 3 minutes of their review of the England game was them chatting about beating some of the fellow journalists in paddle tennis out in Lyon. But there we go. Let's for us get on to the games that you were both at. Let's start off with Ireland against Scotland, and start with Ireland, actually, because back-to-back Six Nations titles, not a Grand Slam, but I don't know, Mark, it's one of those things, isn't it? I think particularly after that defeat at Twickenham, and everyone was so bought into the narrative of first time in Six Nations era that a team's going to do back-to-back Grand Slams, the fact that it hasn't happened. And I don't know if it felt like this in Dublin on Saturday, but it was kind of an understated victory in a way. Whereas actually, when you think about it, winning back-to-back titles is not something Ireland have done a huge amount in their history. And it is just the latest bit of silverware, the latest notch for this team, who continue to achieve some pretty incredible things.
Absolutely. And it was something we were discussing post-match on Saturday, the how kind of, not flat that it felt, but it felt like a box had been ticked. It was quite a routine success for Ireland. That was the vibe that you got in the stadium. And, you know, that is a benchmark for kind of, you know, the standards that team has set, the expectation that's grown around it amongst the public. But it didn't certainly feel like a kind of joyous explosion of, you know, of celebration after the game. And I think there'd been sort of, the Twickenham defeat was such a setback in terms of just how bolt from the blue it appeared to, you know, there were days and days, and certainly in the media, of soul searching around just how this thing had happened, you know, even though it was ultimately not going to cost them the title. And I think there was a sort of a residual flatness in their performance at the weekend, albeit, you know, I think Scotland did contribute to that by finding ways to frustrate them, which have proved utterly beyond them in sort of the nine previous editions of the fixture. So it all felt a little bit kind of flat, but ultimately, you're still left with a team that's performed exceptionally well over the piece and are worthy champions.
Yeah, Elgin, Peter O'Reilly in his match report in the Times said that it kind of felt like Ireland ended up stumbling over the line in the end, which probably wasn't what we expected after those opening three games, where we were looking at the margin of victories in Ireland's games compared to all the other fixtures, and it seemed like Ireland were out ahead of everyone else. But in the end, it was a case of whether it's bit of fatigue or whatever it is, that they kind of got there in the end without it being a complete domination that many expected.
Yeah, I mean, for the first three rounds of the tournament, I was on perfect Grand Slam watch because they were getting try bonus points in every game. They were winning by far more than 7 points, so they were depriving anyone of any points in return. I think they were one try off the perfect slam last year. It was only Scotland that limited them to three, keeping them away from the try bonus point. But, I mean, it shows, again, just how hard it is to win those back-to-back Grand Slams, not since, we mentioned it on the preview Ruck podcast when we were looking forward to this, how not since France in the 97, 98 had anyone done that. And I know a lot of the talk before the tournament was, you know, is it Ireland or is it France who are the favourites? I think a lot of people had France down as the favourites and they thought, you know, will Ireland have a World Cup hangover as bad as France is? In the end, they didn't have a World Cup hangover at all. They had a one-round hangover against Scotland after that defeat by England. But, you know, they could easily have gone there and just suffered on the occasion, knowing that they'd had that bubble burst and that they had that Grand Slam gone. But, you know, they came so close to winning by, you know, far more than four points against Scotland. They caused Scotland to do so much defensive work and came so close to scoring other tries. And, you know, they always say good teams know how to win even when things aren't necessarily going all their way. And they did enough in that last round. They did enough that they had to do, and they can look forward now to a summer test series against South Africa, which will be a real test against the, you know, a lot of people thought Ireland were going to be the world champions. South Africa actually were. So it'll be, you know, a great series this summer.
Oh, I'm fascinated in that summer series. I think it's going to be unbelievable. I can't remember being as excited about a summer tour ever, almost. But anyway, I suppose that's maybe getting a bit ahead of ourselves. One of the interesting things, Mark, when I look at this Ireland team, is over these last couple of games, do you think we have seen the areas that they maybe need to just start sharpening up, which seems strange, and maybe it's the ultimate compliment we can pay this Ireland team in a sense, because they have been so good, they've been so much better than all the other teams in the Northern Hemisphere over the last few years, that as soon as they drop off slightly, all of a sudden we're maybe nitpicking where their game is. But I was at Twickenham the week before and watching from afar the match on the weekend that you were at against Scotland, it just seemed to me like it wasn't quite as well oiled an Ireland machine, especially in an attacking sense, as we've previously seen.
That's right, and I think, you know, you'd be cautious of reading too much into these games, given the body of evidence they've assembled before. But you're right, that machine-like quality wasn't there in either game. And again, is that, you know, teams working them out? Again, you'd be cautious of saying that anybody's worked out Ireland, given that it's only two matches. But they're certainly, you know, that England blitz defence and you know, Scotland's probably more last-ditch goal-line defence found ways to frustrate them, which other teams haven't managed up to now. So, and then as an extension of that, did Ireland have anywhere else to go? Not necessarily. But, you know, they do have some key players out injured as well, who can come back in and reinforce that. And certainly watching that kind of conveyor belt in the URC of talent coming through at the provinces at an under-20 level, I don't see that march being halted anytime soon, frankly. So I would regard this more as a blip rather than anything substantial.
How far continues to develop the team as well, I think, is quite interesting, isn't it? We'll come on to Scotland in just a second, but as brilliant as this team are, you still look at, say, a Conor Murray on the bench or a Kian Healy coming off the bench. At some point over the next year or two, you'd have thought that they will have to start to transition new players in, whether that is this summer when you're going up against the Springboks world champions in South Africa. Maybe it's not quite yet, but at some point he's going to have some pretty big decisions to make about transitioning that team.
Yeah, and obviously there's a question about the captain as well. Peter Mahoney was, you know, very, very visibly emotional before and after the game on Saturday. Says that decision is still to be reached, but the way he was interacting with the crowd, with his teammates, kind of tends to suggest that we might not see him again at this level. But again, it's the perfect environment to be bleeding new talent into, isn't it? When they have got that machine-like quality, it's not, you know, there's no similarity to the Welsh situation that the Elgins watched unfolding, where you're having to sort of throw in guys without armbands. You know, they're coming into a lot of system and a lot of structure. So you'd think that transition process should be very manageable.
Yeah, and we've already seen it with Crowley at fly half, Nash coming in, McCarthy in the second row. They've already done it quite successfully, but there's probably still a few guys that will happen for. From a Scotland perspective, what was your read on this game? Was it a match that restored some pride after the defeat in Rome the week before, or was it just further evidence and an example of this Scotland team. As good as some of the stuff they can do, they have an uncanny ability to be able to shoot themselves in the foot.
Probably both, to be fair. I think they did restore some pride after last week. I mean, if I take myself back to a conversation around the table with some of our peers in Dublin at some stage late on Friday night, potentially even early Saturday morning, the kind of spread of scores that were being predicted there were quite mind-blowing. But there did seem a genuine possibility that that could turn seriously, seriously ugly if Ireland had played to their full potential and had Scotland been anything like as bad as they were in the second half in Rome. But that didn't transpire. They hung in there really well. It was, you know, I suppose the frustration would be that they didn't get anything like their attacking game going until maybe the last 5-10 minutes. But on the flip side of that, you know, a team that's been heavily criticised, and rightly so, for a lack of resilience and a lack of dog, they showed all those qualities. So as Finn Russell said after the game, that set a new benchmark in terms of what they have to be able to produce, and just their kind of general attitude to games, not falling away when things get tough. So yeah, it ended up, you know, after, you know, a campaign of highs and lows, they've ended up mid-table again and not really, you know, not really furthering a case one way or another in terms of whether, you know, there's more to come or whether this is a peak.
I know it got spoken about a lot after the Italy game, Mark, but a mental fragility to this team, in that even watching the game against Ireland, I thought Scotland had a really good first 10-15 minutes or so. They were on top. They end up kicking a penalty to go 3-0 up, and then with a 5-metre line out by their own try line, they overthrow it, and Dan Sheehan has the easiest try he'll ever score. And there were other examples in the game. There was a time when Ireland kicked for touch and you felt like Van der Merwe should have been able to stop the ball going out of play, and he kind of fumbles it into touch. I think that actual penalty was when Xander Fagerson had a kind of a brain freeze almost and was offside, picked up the ball after a player. Just things like that that keep slipping into this Scotland team. And do you think it is a mental fragility?
I think all the signs point in that direction, and it's something that we've talked about for years with Scotland, but it's become more pronounced probably in the last 12 to 18 months, that when the sort of disparity between the best level that they've shown us on occasion and the worst level is so pronounced that there's this massive variation in performance, sometimes in the course of a single game, as Elgin will know from the first weekend of the tournament, where somehow they threatened to blow a 27-point lead in Cardiff, but again we saw it in Rome, you know, potentially the second half of the World Cup game against South Africa as well, where they actually started well and then just fell off a cliff. They have this habit of collectively going missing for long spells in a game, you know, out of nowhere. And when the wheels fall off like that, it's hard to think of, you know, when we know that there isn't any gross technical deficiency in there, it's hard to kind of look in any other direction than upstairs, frankly.
Mark, you mentioned the Wales-Scotland game there. I remember in the aftermath of that, I think Gregor Townsend was sort of suggesting that the referee's interpretations had gone against him on that occasion when they conceded, I think it was 16 penalties to 4. And you're looking again at that Ireland game and it was 13-4, you know, against Scotland. So that's obviously something that they're going to be worried about. Just lots of penalties in a row that, you know, are just going to impact you so negatively.
Massively. And I think if you look at the sort of combined stats for the whole tournament, the difference between penalties won, penalties conceded is fairly consistent for everyone else apart from Scotland, where I think it's a difference of 30 between the two tallies, which is quite incredible, really. And, you know, they have this habit of getting on the wrong side of referees, even with two co-captains and six vice-captains. We don't seem to be able to kind of manage that communication particularly well. And again, it's that ability to adapt under pressure. When you see the way the wind is blowing, the wheels tend to come off rather than good decisions and cool-headed decisions being made. So I think the sort of lack of discipline probably overlaps with that mental issue that we've been talking about, and it's a real stumbling block for the progress of this team.
Mark, I think we asked you on our preview episode way back when now of what constituted success for Scotland in the Six Nations, and I think broadly speaking our answer was essentially closing the gap to probably Ireland and France, still being really in with a shout of winning it come the final weekend. Now, technically, they could have still won it, although none of us, you know, that was never going to happen. So how do you assess this Six Nations for Scotland in terms of success or failure or somewhere in between?
You know, ultimately, it feels somewhere in between, but, you know, all the indicators are pointing downwards in terms of games won, penalties conceded, tries scored, tries conceded, all the key facts. But it does does feel that the team has potentially run out of steam a little bit here, or the whole arrangement between player and coach has run out of steam, that they, you know, in previous years, I think in three of the four most recent editions, they'd won three games, which was widely seen as, you know, that successful. It's not something that had happened previously in the Six Nations era, but they just haven't been able to take that next step to being genuinely competitive in terms of the title. And again this year, they win two games, should have been three with that France game that we've talked endlessly about. But, you know, again, they failed to go into that last weekend with something other than a triple crown to play for, realistically. So, you know, it does feel that, you know, we all like to think that there is more to come from this team, that they have a higher ceiling than just winning three games and finishing third in the Six Nations. But it kind of feels that unless something significant changes about the whole context of that, then, you know, this is perhaps where we're always going to be.
And what does that mean for Gregor Townsend? Not because he hasn't done a brilliant job with this Scotland team, but is there a sense that maybe it's got to a point where he's taken them as far as he can?
I think there is, but on the flip side of that, I think that the, you know, the performance on Saturday may well buy him some more time, because, you know, as I say, there were some very dark thoughts going into that game from supporters and pundits alike, you know, and if it had turned as ugly as people feared, then I think there would only have been one outcome there. But he has a contract until 2026, somewhat oddly a year out from the World Cup, but there's a changing of the guard at the SRU with a new chief executive coming in who we wish to make his or her own mark on things. However, I think he probably will survive to take the team into next year's Six Nations. And again, it's kind of over to him to show that it hasn't run out of steam, that there is more to come here. That, you know, but it does feel a kind of circular conversation where we say, well, this is the best generation of players we've had in the professional era. The depth is building, and we'll do again over a summer tour, which has sort of been deliberately set up to allow him to explore more depth in the outer reaches of that squad. And yet the net result is still the same. Albeit the flip of that is also that he has himself raised the bar in those 7 years, because, you know, they didn't used to beat England, never mind beating them four times in a row. They didn't used to win in Cardiff, Paris, or whatever. So he's ticked off a number of these sort of one-off big items, but turning that into something more substantial is still frustratingly elusive.
Well, interesting. We'll see how Scotland go. Let's move on to Cardiff, Wales and Italy. And let's start with Italy. We'll get on to Wales, and Mark can pitch in here as well, because I know how fond you are of Italian rugby and how much you've covered it. We spoke about it earlier when we mentioned it at the top of the podcast, but do you both think that there really is a sense with Italy that this isn't just it? You know, previous Six Nations, they've got a big win here or there, and it's felt like they've had to scrap and things have had to go their way. Their opposition have had an off day for them to get those victories. Is there a real sense now that hopefully this is an Italian team that are going to be really competitive in the Six Nations for the foreseeable future?
Absolutely. It certainly seems like that, because, you know, as Mark mentioned earlier on, the foundations that underpin this have been there for quite some time. The under-20s team have had a number on the likes of Wales and Scotland's age group teams for quite a few years. Yes, Wales won this time around, but Italy have come on top and come out on top in those under 20 games for quite a few years now. You've got Benetton looking very good in the United Rugby Championship. You've got a lot of excellent young players that have been starring for Italy this year. You know, you look at Tommaso Menoncello, Ross Vincent, who are two 21-year-olds who have both been two of the most dominant players Italy have had in terms of ball carrying and getting over the game line, etc. So everything suggests that this shouldn't be the peak for Italy, that they could do the same next year and hopefully next few years as well.
And I think, you know, another big success that they've had in this tournament, and it was something that had been identified before it by Gonzalo Quezada, was, you know, reconnecting with the Italian rugby public. I mean, to be there in Rome last week when they beat Scotland, it was a sellout at the Olympico, which is the first time they'd done that in over 8 years. And as you know there, it's not, you know, it's a mile away from that kind of more corporate feel that you get at some of the Six Nations grounds. It's a real kind of groundswell of genuine rugby people come from all over the country to watch there. It was so evident to see the connection and the bond that there is with how this team is trying to play, and then to deliver a landmark result like that, the first time they've won in Rome since 2013, really cemented it. And I can only imagine that, you know, that has only increased on the back of the weekend win in Wales. So I think they, you know, there's a groundswell of interest in the team and connection with it. The pro sides are going well. We should throw in Zebre and an honourable mention to them as well, having been absolute cannon fodder for years. They are now giving everyone, you know, they're giving everyone a game and have won a couple as well. So there's progress there too, and some excellent individual players coming through. I think the foundations are in place for them to become something substantial in this tournament in the next couple of years.
We had an email in about Italy, actually. If you want to get in touch with the show, then theruck@thetimes.co.uk is where you can send your correspondence. It was from Connor Smith. Quite a bit of Connor's email about the Ireland performance at Twickenham the week before. But in regards to Italy, heard our conversation about Italy being perhaps the most impressive side in this year's Six Nations. And he said, could you not say essentially that they're one of the most improved sides along with England? He suggests them getting nilled by Ireland means that they're not as impressive as some of the other teams, but they might be one of the most improved sides. Is that a more accurate thing to say? I think judging them purely on being beaten comprehensively by Ireland, I would say, isn't that fair. Their championship wasn't defined by that. But regardless, I think, I don't know, what do you two think? Impressive, most improved? Either way, it's all good signs for Italy.
Yeah, probably somewhere in the middle there. And, you know, there's also to point out that, you know, on the back of that trouncing in Dublin, they then produced, you know, a draw against France, which should have been a win, and then two wins on the bounce. So in terms of a reaction to that, it suggests that there's some metal in there as well, some technical ability. So yeah, I think they'll take either at this stage is probably the reality in terms of where they've been in the last couple of years.
Right, on to Wales then, Elgin. We've put you off long enough. The wooden spoon, first time since 2003. A few different things to get into, really, with this game. The big headline off the back of it, Warren Gatland offering his resignation to the Welsh Rugby Union, which was swiftly rejected. I suppose, first of all, is that the correct call?
I think probably in terms of the financial cost it would take to get a new one, possibly. I mean, the reality is Wales didn't just lose the, well, obviously, Wales were clearly second best on the field over 80 minutes that day. But this is a result that has been coming for several years off the field, because I've already mentioned Tommaso Menoncello, Ross Vincent for Italy, two 21-year-olds who are able to deal with test rugby. Same with France. When France played against Wales, they had three 21-year-olds and a 20-year-old in the back line. And Wales are fielding 22-year-olds who, in the case of, I feel sorry for Evan Lloyd, he's become a bit of a lightning rod for where Wales rugby is at the moment, coming off the bench at hooker, but doing so, having played six times for Cardiff, never as a starter, and now he's playing test rugby. So there do need to be critiques of the way Wales have been coached during the Six Nations, because they just, when they were putting the ball through the hands in Cardiff on Saturday, some of the backs looked like they hadn't met each other. They didn't know where they should be. They weren't running crisp lines. Compare that to Italy, who just knew exactly what they were doing. At times, it looked a bit like a training ground run, the way they were running through their patterns out wide. So they do absolutely have to be questions about how Wales could and should have performed better, given the admittedly low, depleted resources they have. But I don't think it's as simple as saying, oh, a change of head coach will change everything. Just everything about how the regions are funded, how players come through pathways, that all needs to be looked at, and that all needs to improve.
And, well, this maybe leads us on to the pathways, but Steve James, writing in Monday's paper, said that Gatland needed to return to the experience in the squad. He will have some players coming back for the summer tour. Liam Williams, they expect to be available. Gareth Anscombe's return to Gloucester could make him available at some point. Is it a case of perhaps needing to go back to some of the more experienced players that he can pick from? And then naturally, as I just say, it leads us on to the questions of the pathway and players coming through and everything like that.
Certainly the likes of Gareth Anscombe have to come back in, because someone like Gareth has done so well in the past. And a lot of the talk is already on the 2027 World Cup and young players being picked with that in mind. Someone like Gareth Anscombe should, hopefully, if he can stay injury free, you know, he's been so blighted by injuries during his career, he's someone that could still be around then. And again, you're looking at currently the fly half battle is between two 22-year-olds that you know have had good moments but have struggled as well. I think the whole concept of returning en bloc to the departing golden generation is, you know, isn't a panacea for Wales yet again. These young players have to come through and be the new generation of players. Again, there are lots of slightly younger but more established players that were missing, and every team has injuries, but Wales seems to be affected by them more than anyone else because the best player in the position might be able to rival any of their opponents in the Six Nations, but it's that depth chart of who's number two, who's number three, where they always suffer. So in terms of this tournament, we're looking at Dewi Lake and Jack Morgan, who, lest we forget, were the co-captains at the World Cup. Both of them were absent. People like Chris Chunza, Tane Plumtree coming back as well. So there are good players to come back in. So they will inevitably improve the Wales team, but it's not as simple as going, oh, let's pick a bunch of 30, 32, 33-year-olds again, we'll be okay, because that, again, will just be a short-term solution, really.
Yeah, and part of the, I think, frustration and worry, I suppose, for Wales fans is the sense of how long is this going to take, right? It doesn't feel like it's one of those things that, well, you know, let's give them another year to develop it. It's kind of the whole system in terms of the regions, the pathways, as we speak about academies, all that sort of thing that comes into question here. We had a really interesting email come in from Jake Shepherd, actually. So thank you, Jake, for getting in touch. He said, hey, lads, if the tournament had relegation, do you think Wales would have done anything differently? Which I think is a devilishly difficult question to answer, but it's quite an interesting one.
Well, the first thing I'd say is I'm not sure there was a huge amount that could have been done differently. You might consider that instead of Evan Lloyd, for example, they might have gone to a slightly older, slightly more experienced backup hooker rather than picking a 22-year-old who had played 2 hours of pro rugby off the bench for Cardiff. But, you know, that's much of a muchness. It's uncapped players and uncapped players, or uncapped players and people with two caps. So I think one thing that would have happened differently is that, you know, George North and Nick Tompkins probably would have started against France, perhaps, rather than trying Owen Watkin and Joe Roberts in the centres, because they came back in for the Italy game when it was a nominal first choice team available. But the reality is, I don't think there was a huge amount differently that could have been done that was in the locker to do differently.
Yeah, tough road ahead, perhaps. We'll leave it for Wales there now. Just the final thing I want to say as well is I'm really interested, whilst there are multiple selection decisions, I suppose, to make for Wales, that fly half position still interests me. I thought this probably would be the Six Nations that Costello takes the 10 jersey and makes it his own, as you've said already, Elgin. That maybe hasn't quite been the case. So what they do there in a pretty key position, and look, from his point of view, Sam Costello's point of view, that is not easy as a young guy coming into an international team to be the main man at fly half. And when you're in a team that's losing all its games, it's even tougher. But that seems to me to be an important question that Gatland needs to find the answers for. We will leave it there, though, for the time being. Up next, we'll finish off this week's episode. We will look ahead to the Women's Six Nations, and the three of us will name our God or Goddess of the Week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So Women's Six Nations gets underway this weekend. Elgin, you were at the launch event last week. How was it? I saw some photos on social media that essentially made it look like it was in a gift shop.
Well, essentially, because it was. It was hosted at frameless, an immersive gallery in central London, which it was a very nice facility. There were lots of facilities open for the various people that were there doing social media work, which is great. I think the Women's Six Nation is making a big play of...
That's a focus of them, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, that social media angle. And it meant that for the sort of a writer's press conferences, they were taking place in a slightly boarded up gift shop where you could hear people making TikToks around the corner. So there were a few journalists popping around the corner to tell people respectfully to be quiet whilst we were trying to speak to head coaches and players. So it was quite I think the sense from people that have been to the last few is that it was another step up in the quality of a Women's Six Nations launch, but still not perfect environment for it to take place. But no, it's still a step upwards in that regard.
Yeah, and looking ahead to the championship, I mean, England dominant over the last few years. Do we expect English dominance again? And just how important is it, do you think, that someone, realistically, I think France, either beats them or comes very close to beating them, having more competition at that top end for the title?
It's the big issue that the Women's Six Nations struggles with, because obviously it's not the Red Roses' fault that they are so dominant that they've won five tournaments in a row. It's the result of you know, investing in a women's game and having 32 fully contracted professional players that they've won the five tournaments in a row, four Grand Slams. At the time they didn't win a Grand Slam was because it wasn't on offer because of COVID. So that's the only thing that stopped them winning a Grand Slam technically in the past 5 years. You do look at the fixture list and you do think it's going to be four rounds of sort of gentle teeing up and playoffs before that decider, England versus France at the Stade Chaban Delmas in Bordeaux. Last time around, England, in their four games other than France, scored 233 points and conceded 15. So that's what we're staring at in terms of England's dominance. It really does need the likes of Wales, who were third last time round, the best of the rest below England and France, to not necessarily beat England, but just to give them a bloodier nose than they've managed in recent years. They gave them a really good go for half an hour 12 months ago. So what they need to do is just to prolong that performance. And Wales are now slightly further along that road of professionalism. So the hope is that they will, like I say, not necessarily beat them, but even limit it to, you know, 20 points or however many. So that is vital for the growth of the Six Nations. And until it happens, it will always be a big question mark that people wonder, and a question that is always put to England. You know, they're up there winning and people are saying, how important is it for other teams to do better against you? Which is a question they're always asked.
Yeah, Wales I'm really intrigued by. As you say, I remember a lot of the discussion before last year's Six Nations was these contracts that had come in and the impact it would have for Wales. Finishing third, I think, was really good. How they can build on that is going to be fascinating. And they've got Italy at the Principality, don't they?
Yes, they do. There's going to be a game at the Principality, so an upgrade from the Cardiff Arms Park. We've saw last year how much appetite there is for England standalone games when they hosted that decider against France. There were more than 58,000 at Twickenham. And this time around, it won't be France, it'll be Ireland at Twickenham on the penultimate weekend. And yeah, really interesting to see how Wales-Italy goes on April 27th in that fixture. You know, Wales has got some really, really exciting young players coming through. They've got a lot of Gloucester Hartbury representation, who are the top of the Premiership women's rugby. So the hope is that, yes, they can continue that upward trajectory there. They were in WXV1, so they were in the top tier of the inaugural WXV last year. Yes, they didn't win any of their games, but that's where they are. They are the worst of the best teams, or rather the best of the rest, that are competing with those top teams like England, France and New Zealand. So, yeah, it'd be really interesting to see if they can continue that upward trajectory.
Yeah, and as for some of the other teams, Ireland, well, they were last in the Six Nations last year. They were champions of WXV3. It's been a tough old time for Ireland, hasn't it? Anyone that has followed it even remotely has seen a lot of the issues that they've had in terms of the women's team. Are there signs that they might be on an upwards curve, or do you expect it to continue to be tough for the Irish?
I think one of the benefits we've seen of that inaugural WXV is that it has given teams an opportunity to play more matches, to win matches, and to experience an element of taking titles. So we've seen Scotland and Ireland in WXV 2 and 3. Yes, you know, they're playing against the likes of Kazakhstan and Spain rather than England and France, but They're playing games, they're winning games, they're experiencing what it is to be a successful team. So when you're looking at the six teams this year, all of them have got that element of professionalism that a few years ago seemed, you know, a world away. So you would expect to see, and well, certainly hope to see, every team outside of England and France getting better and narrowing that gap. And that's going to be the big thing for the Women's Six Nations moving forward as a competitive competition.
Yeah, and that the same for Scotland and Italy as well, who, again, kind of fifth and fourth last year, did well in WXV2. So how they kick on is going to be fascinating. And is often the thing with the Women's Six Nations. We say that England have cruised to the title, really, in recent years. But some of the storylines and developments amongst the teams below them is always absolutely fascinating. So we'll do our best on the Ruck to keep you abreast of everything in the Women's Six Nations. Just final thing as well, Elgin, flipping it back to England, John Mitchell's first campaign in charge. What do we expect from him? Or his England team, I should say, really, in terms of him as the head coach.
Yeah, I mean, John's done a few media rounds in the past week, and he's been talking about how his first head coaching role in the women's game, it takes him back a bit to 1995 when Union became professional, when he was a player. He keeps on referencing when he was at Sale and there were six full-time players and they would just be sort of hanging around in the day waiting for everyone else to turn up at 5 p.m. after work. So for him, it's been, you know, a real learning experience. He's been talking about the new things he's been learning about the women's game and the things that affect women athletes differently to male athletes. So, you know, it's been a learning experience for him as well. But he's been a successful coach, you know, throughout across the world in a variety of roles. So in that regard, this is a very good appointment for England. It was interesting to hear about Marley Packer, the England captain, who's poised to win her 100th cap when she next takes the field, talking about her relationship with John and how sometimes she thinks they're on the same page and then suddenly that she realizes, oh, we're actually quite different people in this regard. So, you know, it's been very interesting listening to John talk in a very sort of professorial manner, very intense, detailed manner. And as we've mentioned before, the difficulty for him, well, he's dealing with a team that is so used to winning that, you know, has to fight more almost against complacency than against the opponents a lot of the time. So we should see England, they'll solidify their normal strengths. You know, the line-out maul is such a devastating strength for them. But John's very keen for England to become an all-court team. And so perhaps we might see, yes, an all-court game from England where they try and tear everyone to shreds in every manner of rugby, not just line-out maul, which, you know, it's reductive to say they were just a line-out maul team on that, in that 30-game unbeaten run, because they were very good at many things. But diversifying that game and dealing with pressure that will come in World Cup finals against New Zealand, where they've obviously struggled in recent years, will be the key things for them.
Fascinating. Well, it's France against Ireland and Wales against Scotland on Saturday, and then Italy against England on Sunday as the Women's Six Nations gets underway. Let's finish off the pod this week, as we always do, God or Goddess of the Week. Mark, do you want to go first? What direction are you going in?
I'm going to go for Nacho Brix, the Italian midfielder who's been a standout in this competition, particularly in the final 2 weeks against Scotland and Wales. I think it's been key to bringing that degree of balance that we talked about earlier in the pod. He is an excellent running threat, but also makes some excellent decisions, guiding the people around him. A fine distributor too. So I think he's, you know, even before the tournament, there was talk that he might not get in the team, given the number of options they have there, but he's established himself as a key part of that side that's heading in an upward trajectory.
I've been toying with selecting Tommaso Menoncello, but we can't have two Italian centres as the gods of the week, so sadly Tommaso will have to give way to another 21-year-old. I'm going to go for Nolan Le Garec. The French scrum halves are a particular area of interest for me, a particular area of love, and to see him getting on the end of that thrilling 80-metre move by France in typical poetic French scrum half style was the champagne moment of the final weekend for me. That superb try that involved, yeah, Leo Barre out wide as well, another 21-year-old fullback. So, yeah, I'm going for Nolan Le Garec, the long-term heir to the greatest of all time, Antoine Dupont, at scrum half for France.
Yeah, two good nominations. I will go with George Ford. We heard Will and Alex speak a lot about him in their chat looking back on the France-England game. I think he's had a really good Six Nations, a guy who, at his best, his ability to marshal a team and to get them in the right places has perhaps been a little bit underappreciated at international level over the years. And I think, again, in this Six Nations, a bit like how we saw in the first game of the World Cup against Argentina, where you felt like he just took that game by the scruff of the neck and guided England to a really important win. He's been really important, I think, for how this England team have developed. We've, for years, going all the way back to Eddie Jones, been hearing about how England's attack is coming, it's coming, it's coming, and then it never does. Whereas this Six Nations, you feel like there is real reason for positivity, I think, amongst England fans. And I think George Ford has been a crucial crux of that. So he gets my nomination. But Elgin, Mark, thanks for joining me. What happens for you two now? Six Nations over. Where do your attentions turn? Is it all just back into the domestic game?
Well, the first time going on a busman's holiday to the south of France to watch four rugby matches in the space of 3 days with a few fellow south of France rugby acolytes. So there'll be plenty of singing and plenty of rugby watching, and very much looking forward to that. And then, yeah, back to a bit of rugby and wherever the sporting calendar takes me. I never know 1 week from the next. So, we'll see where I end up after that.
I'm straight back into the glorious finale to the URC season, Glasgow v Cardiff at Scotstoun on Friday, which I imagine will be very similar to Dublin on St Pat's weekend, with Ireland going for a back-to-back titles. So yes, never a dull moment.
Never a dull moment. Well, pleasure as always, gentlemen. Thank you to everyone for listening as well. Do leave us a review wherever you get your pod from. And don't forget, if you want to get in touch with the show, the email address is theruck@thetimes.co.uk. Will Kelleher has the control of that inbox, but we will get to as many of your emails in each podcast as we can. Have a great week. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next Monday.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.